Welcome back to the deep dive. I want you to just look around the room you're sitting in right now.
Yeah, just take a quick scan of the space.
Right, and if I asked you to point to the most permanent, historically significant thing in that space, you'd probably point to the foundation, right? Or the structural beams, or maybe the heavy walls.
Absolutely. It's just human nature.
Yeah, exactly. Because when you stand in front of a massive stone structure, like maybe a ruin built by some empire centuries ago, your brain instantly does this sort of calculation. You look at those huge, heavy blocks, and your instinct just says, permanent, important.
Right. We are just so deeply conditioned to equate that physical, monumental weight with actual historical significance.
We really are.
I mean, it is entirely tactile.
Right.
You can walk right up and touch the stone, you can measure its dimensions, and you can read the bronze plaque attached to it.
Yeah, the official plaque.
Exactly. So it just feels like it inherently matters more than, say, a fleeting human moment. It commands respect and dictates the historical narrative simply by taking up space and just refusing to move.
But what if we took that 200-year-old imperial stone wall, right, and we put it on a cosmic scale, and then on the exact opposite side of that scale, we placed a Colombian mother simply enjoying her family vacation.
Okay, wow. That is quite the visual.
Right. So which one of those actually carries more historical weight?
Well, I mean, most observers wouldn't even hesitate with that calculation. They would point straight to the stones of the empire, obviously. But what's fascinating here is how the material we're exploring today is going to take that exact assumption, totally dismantle it, and flip it completely upside down.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because our mission for this deep dive is to explore exactly how those two concepts, heavy official textbook history and intimate subjective family photo album history, are kind of forced to coexist in the exact same visual space.
Yeah, side by side.
And more importantly, we are going to look at why doing so completely changes how you value your own past. We're looking at a truly breathtaking watercolor painting today. It's titled In Mission Capistrano, and it was created by the artist Jairo Duque.
And we also have a remarkably transparent stack of sources on the table to guide us today, which is great. We are not just, you know, randomly guessing at the artist's aesthetic intentions here.
No, we really are. We have Jairo Duque's personal artistic notes, a highly detailed, high-resolution image of the painting itself, and the complete technical data sheet, the Ficha Technica. So we have the what, the how, and the why mapped out right in front of us.
Which is so rare. And setting the parameters early here is crucial, I think. We are not just doing some dry academic breakdown of color theory or like a critique of architectural perspective.
Right. This isn't an art school lecture.
Exactly. This deep dive is about stepping into a philosophical space where collective, massive colonial history basically crashes head on into the fragile middle of personal memory.
I love that.
Yeah.
But before we let ourselves get completely swept away by all that philosophical and emotional gravity, I really have to understand the physical foundation first.
Sure. Lay the groundwork.
Yeah. I need to know how the house was built before we discuss who lives inside it, you know? Looking at the technical data sheet, a really specific detail immediately jumped out at me regarding the timeline and the geography.
Oh, the Whittier studio thing.
Yes. The artist took his reference photo for this painting in July of 2022 while he was physically standing on the grounds of the mission in California.
Right.
But he didn't actually paint it there. The sheet specifically lists his studio in Whittier, California, as the actual place of creation.
And that geographical and temporal distance from the subject is absolutely vital to understanding the final piece. It really is.
But why create that distance, though?
Yeah.
I mean, as a painter, wouldn't the ultimate goal be to capture the reality of the space right then and there?
You'd think so, yeah.
Like setting up an easel on the grass right in front of the building, working on plein air. That gives you the authentic California sun, the immediate atmosphere. Why pack up all your gear, take a reference photo, and retreat to a studio miles away to execute the actual brushwork?
Well, for this particular artist, a studio in Whittier functioned as a sort of distillation laboratory rather than just a room with convenient lighting.
A distillation laboratory?
Yeah. Consider the reality of being on site at a highly famous historical monument. It is chaotic. You are dealing with the blazing, unfiltered intensity of the afternoon sun drying your paints way too quickly.
Oh, true. Watercolor dries fast.
Exactly. And you have like 50 tourists bumping into your easel to take selfies. You have the ambient noise of nearby traffic. The environment is just too immediate. By taking the visual data back to the highly controlled environment of the studio, the artist grants himself a necessary moment of psychological pause.
I see. So the studio light allows him to control the creative depth, essentially separating the raw visual data from the emotional core of the memory.
Precisely. The pause ensures he is not just painting a journalistic objective report of what the mission looked like on a random Tuesday at 2 p.m.
Right. He's not just a human camera.
Exactly. The image is being deliberately filtered through human emotion and distilled over time. He is painting what the moment actually felt like, which requires quiet reflection that a crowded tourist destination simply does not offer.
That makes a lot of sense. And the physical materials he chose to translate that distilled emotion, they're also incredibly specific and deliberate.
Oh, the materials are fascinating.
Yeah, the technical sheet notes he used high-quality Daniel Smith paints on a 15 by 11 inch, 300-gram cold-pressed watercolor paper. For anyone familiar with art supplies, 300-gram paper is substantial.
It is very heavy-duty.
Yeah, it's like expensive, heavy stationery. It's thick, heavy material designed to absorb a massive volume of water without warping, curling like a potato chip, or deteriorating under the brush.
And the cold-pressed specification is where the actual physics of the artistic illusion takes place. Cold-pressed paper possesses what watercolorists refer to as tooth, or diente.
Now, I am familiar with the concept of tooth when we talk about canvas, but how does it function differently when you are dealing with a fluid medium like watercolor?
So if you were to examine this specific 300-gram paper under a microscope, the surface is not uniformly flat at all. It resembles a rugged landscape of microscopic peaks and valleys.
Okay, I'm picturing that.
When you mix a high-quality heavy pigment, like those specific mineral-based Daniel Smith paints used here, with water and drag your brush across that surface, gravity basically takes over.
It sinks in.
Right. The heavy pigment particles naturally fall and settle into those microscopic valleys, while the peaks remain relatively clear.
Oh, wow. So the material itself is organically generating the texture. The artist isn't like individually painting every single pit and groove of the stone.
Exactly. The paper is essentially doing half of the atmospheric heavy lifting for him. As the pigment settles unevenly into the paper's tooth, it inherently mimics the complex, varied visual texture of real, weathered, centuries-old stone.
That is brilliant. I understand the mechanics of the texture now, but I am honestly still questioning watercolor as the appropriate medium for a subject with this much historical gravity.
Why is that?
Because it is notoriously unforgiving. If you misjudge a shadow in an oil painting, you can scrape the canvas or just paint a thick, opaque layer over the mistake, you know?
Very true. Oils are very forgiving.
But watercolor is essentially tinted water. You cannot hide your errors, and it naturally leans toward light, airy compositions. How does he build the sheer heavy presence of stone with transparent water?
Well, he utilizes a highly calculated high-risk technique called veladuras, or glazes. It's a process of extreme patience.
Walk me through the mechanics of a glaze in this context. How does that work?
Okay, picture taking several different colored sheets of highly transparent cellophane
right.
and laying them flat on top of one another.
Okay.
In watercolor, you lay down a broad, pale wash of light blue, maybe, to establish the atmosphere, and then you must wait for it to dry completely. If you rush it, it turns into mud.
Oh, I hate that.
It's the worst. So once it's dry, you lay down a wash of warm ochre, you let that dry, then a deeper shadow tone. Layer after layer, you are building density.
So you're basically constructing a transparent window rather than a solid wall of paint.
Yes. Because watercolor pigments retain their transparency, the environmental light in the room where you are viewing the painting actually travels through all those accumulated layers of pigment.
Wait, really? It goes all the way through?
It does. The light hits the pure white reflective surface of the 300-gram paper at the very bottom and then bounces back out into your eye.
Oh, wow. Which explains why masterfully executed watercolors appear to possess this kind of internal glow. So the illusion of the sun-baked stone isn't merely a trick of color mixing. It is the literal physics of light interacting with the structural layers he built in that Whittier studio.
And the medium itself becomes a metaphor for the passage of time, you know? Layers of experience building upon one another, yet always remaining visible through the surface.
Okay, now that we have established how the illusion of this glowing stone was physically manifested on the paper, we really need to address the actual historical colossus depicted in the background.
Yes, the mission itself.
The setting is Mission San Juan Capistrano, And we have to establish the sheer historical gravity of this location to understand the tension in the painting.
This is far more than a picturesque architectural relic. Founded in November of 1776 by Junipero Serra, it is the seventh of the 21 Alta California missions. It is widely documented in historical texts as the jewel of the missions.
Right. And looking at it impartially through the lens of our sources, the mission is an undeniable, concrete symbol of colonization.
It absolutely is.
It represents intense cultural collision, the projection of imperial power, and aggressive territorial expansion. When an empire mobilizes the resources to construct a massive stone complex like this, it is leaving an indelible footprint on the earth. It is a structural declaration stating, we are here and this land is ours.
Yes.
And understanding the historical fallout of that declaration requires volumes of encyclopedias.
Jairo Duke's personal notes reveal he is acutely aware of this heavy colonial context. He does not approach the mission merely as a charming architectural backdrop or a fossilized dead ruin.
How does he approach it, then?
He paints it as a space vibrating with living memory. It holds centuries of complex human encounters and represents unyielding institutional permanence. It is official collective history, quite literally set in stone.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the ultimate plot twist of this composition is placed directly in the center of the paper.
Oh, yeah. The contrast is striking.
You have this towering, historically loaded background dominating the space. But the focal point, the absolute center of the painting, isn't a colonial bell, and it isn't an imperial crest.
No, it's not.
It is a solitary human figure. It is the artist's elderly mother.
According to the source notes, she is depicted posing during what would be her final international trip, having traveled all the way from Cali, Colombia to Southern California.
I need to push back on the visual hierarchy here, though.
Okay, go ahead.
If we look at this objectively, to a casual observer scrolling past this image on their phone, doesn't this run the risk of just looking like a classic, somewhat annoying tourist photo?
I mean, I see where you're going with that.
We've all experienced this, right? You travel to see a famous monument, and someone's mother steps right into the middle of the frame, totally blocking the view of the history you actually came to witness.
It would be incredibly easy to dismiss it as a standard vacation snapshot if the execution weren't so deliberate. The artist is hyper aware of that tourist trope and actively subverts it.
Subverts it how?
He does not position her as an accidental obstruction. In his notes, he refers to her as a silent witness to human transit.
But how does he actually achieve that subversion visually? Philosophy is great, but if I take a photo of my mom in front of a church, she just looks like she's in the way. What is Duke doing with his brushes to elevate her beyond a tourist?
Well, he manipulates the light and the integration of the figure with the environment. Think about a tourist photo. The flash or the harsh sun separates the person from the background they look pasted on, right?
Yeah, totally flat.
Duke bathes the mother in the exact same luminous layered glazes as the ancient stone. The light hitting her shaders is the exact same light warming the arches. She is visually anchored into the environment. He is giving her figure equal structural dignity to the centuries-old walls behind her.
Wow. So he is forcing a deliberate collision of narratives. The massive public history of imperial colonization is being actively interrupted by a completely private, deeply personal journey.
Exactly. And this collision raises an essential philosophical question. How can an artist justify taking an ordinary private citizen and elevating her to the exact same historical and visual level as a monument of colonial empire?
The sources actually provide a really striking analogy from the artist's own notes to justify exactly that. He calls it the parallelism of builders.
Yes, that concept totally reframes our definition of legacy. Think about how official history operates. Empires are the ultimate builders. They erect colossal stone monuments specifically to dominate a physical landscape.
And they build them with the explicit intention of being documented. They demand the bronze plaques, the statues, the chapters in history books.
Right. They require visible proof of their conquests and their endurance.
So where does his mother fit into that?
Duke argues that a mother is equally a tireless builder. She's just operating in a different medium. Over decades, she constructs a family, she cements ethical values, she raises children, and she lays down what he beautifully terms invisible bricks of affection, sacrifice, and care.
The fundamental difference being that her invisible bricks do not receive bronze plaques. They don't get debated by historians or protected by historical societies.
No, they rarely enter the official documented record of humanity at all, What this painting attempts to do is balance those cosmic scales.
I see.
It visually asserts that the monumental, exhausting, decades-long effort of a single human life carries the exact same historical weight and validity as the sprawling stone-and-mortar effort of an empire.
If the overarching goal is to honor his mother that profoundly, to literally elevate her to the status of a monument, I have another critical question about his execution.
What's that?
Looking closely at the high-resolution image, why isn't she painted with hyper-realistic photographic detail?
Oh, that's a great point.
You cannot count the individual wrinkles on her face, nor can you determine the exact thread count of her clothing. Her features are distinctly simplified. They border on the abstract, almost melting into the bright ambient light of the Mission Garden. Why choose abstraction when trying to immortalize someone you love?
Well, because if he had executed her portrait with absolute 4K photographic perfection, it would fundamentally change how you interact with the painting. What would your brain be focused on if the detail was flawless?
I mean, I would immediately focus on the technique. I would look at the way the light reflects off a specific button or the exact rendering of the fabric folds. And I just admire the painter's technical skill.
Exactly. You would be distracted by the painter's technical virtuosity. The conversation would shift from the emotional weight of the mother to the impressive mechanics of the artist. You'd be analyzing his brushwork instead of feeling her presence.
That makes total sense. Human memory doesn't function like a high-definition digital file anyway.
Right. It really doesn't.
When I try to recall a family vacation I took 10 years ago, I don't remember the exact texture of the gravel I was standing on or the precise logo on a passing car. My brain didn't store the metadata. I remember the sensation of the afternoon sun. I remember the feeling of calm or the specific tone of someone's laugh.
You remember the emotional essence. By intentionally simplifying her figure, the artist is capturing the pure sensation of the memory rather than a cold catalog of visual facts.
It's about the feeling.
Right. He wants you to feel the warmth of that specific day in California, the serenity of the garden, and the quiet dignity of her presence. The memory is an emotional state, not a forensic photograph.
This friction between monumental permanence and fleeting human moments brings us to a biological clock ticking in the background of the painting.
Oh, the swallows.
Yes. If we look away from the mother in the center and examine the bright blue sky above the mission arches, there is another subtle narrative layer. There are delicate, almost whispering brushstrokes in the sky. Birds. And within the specific context of San Juan Capistrano, we know those are not just random seagulls.
No, they are the famous migrating swallows, the golondrinas.
Every year, traditionally celebrated around March 19th, thousands of these specific birds fly incredible distances across continents to return to the exact same cornices and ruins of this specific mission.
And the way he integrates them into the composition is vital. He does not paint a massive National Geographic-style black cloud of birds blocking the sun.
Right, it's not a Hitchcock movie.
No, they're subtle. They serve as a literary device within the visual space.
How do they function as a literary device?
Well, the swallows are the ultimate biological emblem of return, of life cycles, and of unbreakable continuity. Consider the paradox here. The colonial empire that built the mission has long since fallen.
Right, long gone.
The era has ended, and the massive stones are quite literally crumbling into ruin. Yet the fragile birds still find their way home across thousands of miles. They endure long after the empire collapses. Just as the swallows always return to the physical space of the mission, human memory inevitably returns to the people who shaped us.
That is beautiful. The heavy, imposing stones stay put and slowly decay, but the fragile life, the migrating birds, the traveling mother, the enduring memory, it just keeps moving, acting, and returning.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the artist's personal notes reveal a very sharp social critique embedded beneath the peaceful surface of this watercolor.
A social critique. What is he critiquing?
He is challenging the terrible habit modern society has of viewing both ancient ruins and elderly people through the exact same lens of condescension.
Oh, wow. We do that. We tend to categorize them both as finished chapters. We visit the ruins on a Sunday afternoon. We visit our elderly relatives. We take a quick photo. We label them as quaint or cute. And then we just leave them behind.
Exactly.
We firmly categorize both the architecture and the person as belonging entirely to the past.
We treat them as inactive relics. But the painting refuses to let you view them as relics.
By bathing both the 18th century stone wall and the modern day mother in the exact same active, vibrant light, Duke is forcing them both into the present tense.
Yes, the present.
The mission isn't just a dead historical footprint. It is actively casting dark, real shadows in the sun today. It is actively sheltering living birds today. And the mother isn't a passive memory fading away. She is actively undertaking exhausting international flights from Colombia today. They both boldly and actively inhabit the now.
It really acts as a profound reclamation of dignity for the elderly. It asserts that they are still witnessing the world, still traveling, still building, and still fully participating in the present moment. They hold just as much relevance as the history we put behind velvet ropes.
So what does this all mean? When we pull all these disparate threads together, the controlled distillation of the Whittier studio, the physics of the 300-gram paper, the heavy footprint of colonial history, the silent dignity of the mother, the biological clock of the swallows, it all synthesizes perfectly through the choice of medium itself, watercolor.
Watercolor really proves to be the perfect bridge for these opposing forces.
It truly is, because on one side of the scale, you have the cold, rigid, objective, encyclopedic data of colonial history. On the other side, you have the warm, fragile, highly subjective intimacy of a son's gratitude toward his mother.
And the fluid, transparent light of the watercolor medium organically unites those two extremes, proving they can occupy the exact same space without destroying each other.
That's amazing.
And this unpretentious, deeply personal act of family gratitude resonated so strongly and touched on such a universal human truth that it did not remain hidden in that California studio.
No, it didn't.
In July of 2024, this exact piece was exhibited internationally at the Art Boxy Gallery within the Cipri Art Gallery in Venice, Italy.
It transitioned from a highly private, subjective memory of a Colombian mother in California all the way to a public gallery in Venice, communicating with an entirely different culture.
And that trajectory proves the absolute superpower of art. It possesses the unique...
Exactly. Look around your own home today. Pay attention to the people in it. What are the invisible, silent monuments of care being built by your family members right now without ever asking for applause and without ever needing a plaque? And what if, long after the heavy stone walls of our modern society inevitably crumble, those quiet, fleeting moments of family connection are actually the most indestructible structures humanity will ever build?
That is just a remarkable thought to carry forward into your day.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a moment to appreciate the invisible bricks being laid in your own life today. We'll catch you next time.